Blog Talk Radio.
We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, do ordain and establish this
and
Constitution,
go, my fellow Americans,
the United States of America.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do.
This nation, under God, shall have a new birth of freedom, and the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
For peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
From the very heart of the Constitutional Republic of the United States of America, from the soul of the Bellwether State, Missouri Grassroots Radio is live.
Just one more. I just want to know if the Senate's going to pass a budget anytime soon.
The Senate passed the budget last August. In fact, we did better. I've always complained about the way we did these budget resolutions because they're phony baloney. Every year we pass a resolution and it doesn't even have force of law. And the appropriators would have just completely ignore it. So last August, for the first time that I've been there, we put it into law for 2 years, the budget for 2 years, and actually 10 years going forward, but legal spending caps for 2 years. And guess what happened this year? The appropriators followed it.
Just one more. I just want to know if the Senate's going to pass a budget anytime soon.
The Senate passed the budget last August. In fact, we did better. I've always complained about the way we did these budget resolutions because they're phony baloney. Every year we pass a resolution and it doesn't even have force of law. And the appropriators would have just completely ignore it. So last August, for the first time that I've been there, we put it into law for 2 years, the budget for 2 years, and actually 10 years going forward, but legal spending caps for 2 years. And guess what happened this year? The appropriators followed it. For the first time since I've been there. So them telling, this is Fox News and a talking point by the political right, that we haven't passed a budget. We not only passed one, for the first time it's in law, signed by the president, and we must follow it, and it is bringing down spending, and it is bringing down the number of federal employees.
I will be held accountable. I've got 4 years. If I don't have this done in 3 years, then there's going to be a one-term proposition.
Hey, free market capitalist Missouri business owners, show Missouri and the rest of the country what hardworking, successful entrepreneurship looks like by advertising your business on Missouri Grassroots Radio. Get your message out to liberty-loving citizens who want to support liberty-loving capitalists. Target this unique and widespread market with your business's unique and valuable products and services. Contact us at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org for details.
With the August primary looming in about 7 weeks, we find that time is running out on who we vote for. Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? Do the representatives we send to Jefferson City really care what you think, or do they do the bidding of the special interest groups and lobbyists? It's your choice. You can elect a true citizen legislator or an establishment politician who takes his marching orders from the party elitists and his donors. Either way, time is running out for our state and country. Hear the clock of freedom ticking? I'm Terry Varner, and I approve this message.
So dear, for peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery. Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death.
Here we're back. Here we're back. It's the Missouri Grassroots Radio Network. This is the Hour of Truth. I'm Dave Court. I witnessed something today that made me laugh, made me incredibly angry, and I controlled myself from saying something out loud, and then absolutely broke my heart, all three at the same time. I was standing in the convenience store buying my Mark Block Vice product when the couple and child in front of me were buying two candy bars, a pack of beef jerky, and a bag of chips and a soda. The lady took her EBT card out of her purse and gave it to her son, who could not have been more than 8 years old, and showed him how to enter the PIN number for the card. And I'm thinking, this is tragic. I mean, brothers and sisters, I don't know if we can save this country anymore. We are teaching the next generation how to be moochers. We've got Carl Bearden here tonight. Carl, you're welcome, and thank you for coming.
Hey, thanks for having me back, Dave.
Oh, no, it's great. I'm really, really, really enjoying this, and I hope our audience is too. Listen up, audience. It's 347-677-1835, 347-677-1835. I don't know if you caught us as you were coming in, Carl, but we gave our buddy Claire a little bashing tonight over her her announcement that she had passed a budget single-handedly, I guess, because nobody else knows about this. So I guess her and Obama single-handedly passed this budget back in August, and now they're bringing down federal spending. Yeah. Okay, Carl.
That was amazing. Well, yeah. You know, she also voted to increase our electric rates yesterday
exactly.
By quite a bit. So there's a big blog. We've been covering that for on our blog at unitedformissouri.org. So, and it's funny because she has on her campaign site how she's standing up against her party and against EPA regulations, and then she votes for her party and EPA regulations. So.
Yep, that was right. Break that down just real quick in about a minute and a half, Carl, and tell everybody what you're talking about. I've been following that over there at Missouri, United for Missouri, but I imagine some of our listeners aren't quite sure about what you're talking about.
Well, as part of Obama's war on coal, he has his EPA putting out regulations on mercury and other pollutants that are really aren't the problem. It's hydrogen sulfide and all the other stuff that they've been working on. So what would happen is that it would put out most of the coal-generating plants in the country, including Missouri. And in Missouri, we get 81% of our electrical generation capacity comes from coal-fired plants. So if you put out even half of the plants that we get it from, we're talking about a huge spike and increase in electrical rates. Plus, the jobs that are created by the use of that coal just in the industry in Missouri are 4,600 jobs. So yesterday there was the opportunity for the good senator to vote for Senate Joint Resolution 37, which was sponsored by Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma, that would just bring the bill to the floor for debate that would stop the EPA regulations and stop the tripling and quadrupling, in some cases, of our electrical rates. The good senator, even though, again, on her campaign website now, it's a campaign, so you know you got to take it for what it's worth, and she's showing us what it's worth. She says that she is not afraid to stand up against her party and that she will fight for her constituents against needless EPA regulations. But in fact, yesterday when she had the opportunity to do that, she voted against her constituents and for Obama and his EPA bureaucrats. So she's showing her true colors. She can say one thing on her website. She can say one thing in her commercials. But if you see her record, it's quite different.
And while what's the number? 61% of our electricity, Carl? 81. And while 81% of our electricity, I didn't remember that number, but I do remember this one coming up. Well, 81% of our electricity comes from coal-fired plants. Take a guess at how much mercury in the atmosphere comes from the burning of coal. 0.0 0.6. 0.6% of the mercury in the atmosphere comes from the burning of coal, and this is an evil that Claire and Barack think they have to fight. And that goes to show you, folks, it has nothing to do with mercury. It is not about mercury. It is absolutely about the ideology and the agenda of this administration. And they have an ideology, folks, and they have an agenda, and it is moving forward, and we're here to stop it. Okay, what we're here for tonight, though, Carl, is to continue our discussion. Listen, audience, it's 347-677-1835. Get in on this. Schoolhouse Rock Revisited. We started talking to Carl last week about how a bill becomes a law, and I'm going to review here just really quickly in about 60 or 70 seconds. I came to work one morning as a representative from Missouri 674 district, and I drove my car in a ditch on the way to the Capitol building because I was watching some birds in a birdhouse. So when I got to the office, I decided that I wanted to make it a rule that you could not have a birdhouse within 25 feet of the street to keep from distracting drivers. And I sent that idea over to the people who write legislation, and there's an office of people who, and that's what they do. These are full-time people. They don't come and go every 4 years, but they are experts at writing, at getting the wording right in legislation. And they sent it back to me and said, "Okay, Dave, is this really what you wanted?" Because they don't make laws. They do what I tell them to do. And so I looked at it and I said, "Yeah, that's in fact what I want." And we carried it down to the House floor and we read it once. And the Speaker of the House nodded his head in the right direction, and he referred it to the Committee for Urban Uniformity. And while it was in the committee, it had a public hearing, and some of you went down and said, you know, you really liked this or didn't like it, and some of you said that it would be better if it was worded like this. And so the committee then went into executive session, and they proposed some amendments. Someone thought that it should be 50 feet instead of 25 feet. And so that was Amendment 1. And then Amendment 2, somebody thought that the pole should be 25 feet high, and that amendment passed as well. Then there was an amendment to the amendment that said that the 25-foot pole needed to be either uncolored or painted white. And then some guy from up in the northeast part of the state somewhere, I'm sure, also wanted to add on an amendment that says all dog houses must be painted red. And so all of those amendments passed in committee, and they got all rolled together because – am I right here, Carl? The reason for what we're getting ready to do is because if it went to the floor exactly the way I just said it, they would have to vote in the full House on all those amendments before they voted on the bill.
Correct.
Right. So instead of having to go through that rigmarole, they just rolled all those amendments together and they made a new bill called House Committee Substitute 1 for House Bill 1. And, so that bill then was the bill that I got back from the writer with all these amendments incorporated into it. So now you have to have your birdhouse 50 feet from the street on a 25-foot pole painted white. And if you have a doghouse too, it has to be red. It went to the House, and we didn't attach any amendments to it, but the House then on their own, the full House, could have proposed more amendments. Right, Carl?
Correct.
Okay.
Many more.
They could have proposed any number of amendments, and in fact, if it was the end of the session, if it was the last week of the session where this was one of the last few bills that comes up, it's entirely likely that this would have an amendment on it that has something to do with the paint stripes in a church parking lot, and an amendment on it that has something to do with how the state patrol can dispose of used vehicles, and another amendment that has something to do with how you have to register the buying of ammunition when you go to a sporting goods store. Right, Carl? I mean, they just start slapping amendments on bills.
Right.
So okay. You get – so go ahead.
Yeah, they take their opportunity. Usually there are some restrictions, you know, the chapter, the statute chapter has to be open. They've gotten a little more looser with that over the last few years. But yes, they can, anything that will fit in there, they'll try.
Right. So what you end up with then is a birdhouse bill with a title. So when you're going through the title of all the bills that passed, you're going to see this Birdhouse Uniformity Act. The bill always has a title, House Committee Substitute 1 for House Bill 1. And then if you actually read the bill, you get down and you find these other ungermane amendments attached to the bottom. But that didn't happen to this one. This one came out, and House Committee Substitute 1 for House Bill 1 was truly passed and sent over to the Senate, and that's where we pick it up today. So now it's in the Senate. It's just arrived at the Senate. Some Senate messenger is announcing to the House, to the Senate President Pro Tem, that this bill is being delivered. Now what happens, Carl?
Right. So that's kind of a key deal, because in the last few years this has been an issue. So what happens is, once the bill passes the House, the chief clerk prepares a letter to the Senate stating that it's been officially passed and so on and so forth, and then they message that, carry that over to the Senate, and the Senate has the opportunity to what they call receive that message. And when they do that, they receive the bill along with the message. Now, if they don't want the bill, for whatever reason, they're in some little tiff or whatever, they will refuse the message, which means that the bill never gets delivered to the Senate until they actually accept it. So they've used that a couple of times last year, this past session, rather. So it's becoming a little more prevalent than it used to be. But let's assume that they obviously received it.
Let me interrupt just for a second and make sure that I and everyone understands this. The fact that the House passed the bill doesn't necessarily mean the Senate even has to acknowledge the fact that there is a passed bill out there.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Okay.
But more times than not, 99 times out of 100 or 98
right.
times out of 100, they receive the bill.
Okay.
And then what happens, the procedure on the floor is that the floor leader of the Senate will ask the president pro tem of the Senate if there are any messages from the House. They'll say yes, and they will read this message in, that the House of Representatives reports that, you know, House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1 has been perfected and third read and passed, blah, 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 clerk of the House. That's actually the first reading of the bill. And then the next day, similar to the House, there'll be a second reading, but it'll only be printed in the journal. It won't be read again. Then it, just like in the House, it goes and is in the possession of the president pro tem of the Senate. And just like the Speaker, the president pro tem decides what committee he or she wants to send it to, when he or she wants to send it to that committee, if at all, until the last day of session. So now the Senate has much fewer committees than the House does. There's 163 House members, so they try to keep them all busy, and there's only 34 senators. So there's much reduced number of committees, and so he picks a committee to send it to. And then just in the House, the committee chairman decides when or even if he will hold a hearing on that bill.
Okay.
So in our
There's going to be another public hearing.
Correct. So the chairman of just like in the House, the chairman of this committee that's been sent to in the Senate will publish a notice again within 24 hours of the hearing, at least, that he is now going to hear and take testimony on House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1, just like in the House, just in the committee. So here's your second bite at the apple.
Right.
If you're for it, you probably want to be there and say, yeah, this is better than sliced bread. If you're against it, you can tell them again why this is a bad idea, and so on and so forth. Same process, although in the Senate you will find the Senate really doesn't want to hear that much from you. They hold these public hearings. They want you to be as brief as possible. They would prefer that you say you're for or against the bill and turn in written testimony. They're really not into a lot of long testimony, as much as the House may be.
I
so,
see.
And particularly, they don't do that quite so much on real people. you know, have traveled. But if you're in the Capitol at all, you know, regularly, they will expect you to keep it short and not take up a lot of their time.
And is that just the tradition, or is there a practical reason for that, Carl?
Well, they're trying to squeeze it in. It's more the way that they've always operated. It's really not a good excuse for it. You know, the purpose of a public hearing is have the public airing.
Right.
And that's not to say that you're going to get, you know, forever infinitum time to say your piece or to have this long meeting to have everyone testify. There are limitations in their time and everything.
Right.
And so there are reasonable limitations, but in the Senate they've kind of carried that out to, you know, you for it or against it, and if you are, just tell us that and submit written testimony.
Okay.
So that's what they prefer. They'll give you higher marks if you do that.
I see. So now it's in the Senate. It's in the Senate. It's had its public hearing. And listen, folks, now, this is, as Carl said, your second bite at the apple. So these are the important things to look for if you're following this bill, is these two public hearings, the one in the House, and now you get another shot at it in the Senate. So these are important input points for you. And as Carl and I have discussed in the past, they're not the only input points, but they are the ones where someone is actually seeking your voice, and in pretend listening to it, and this is where you get to say your piece for sure.
Right, and so same thing. You know, you have the public hearing. Now the Senate very rarely, unlike the House will sometimes have a public hearing and an executive session on the bill in the same day. The Senate, it's very rare for that to happen.
Okay.
So they will take that testimony, then it will be some time before they take up the bill. It could be at their next meeting the next week, but usually what will happen, the chairman will try to gauge, you know, what's the support for this bill in the committee and so on and so forth, you know, how hard is he going to have to fight for it, you know, how important is it, and so on and so forth. So once he's kind of figured that out and he wants to bring the bill forward, there'll also be things like, okay, well, now we see what the House has done, and we know what the title in the House is, but we think it ought to be a little broader. It ought to deal with houses, period. All right, so they come up with a Senate committee substitute, which, you know, takes out birdhouses and just puts it in houses. And now you've got, you know, you can't have a house that's bigger than, you know, 10 by 20. And stuff like that, whatever. And so they start to expand this bill even further.
Wow.
On the Senate, and so they take that up, they offer it, it passes out of committee, and so now you have Senate committee substitute, the House committee substitute for House Bill 1.
Right.
And so what the Senate does then is the chairman holds on to those bills similar to the House, and the pro tem will let the chairman of every committee know, we're going to have reports from committee today, and I want you to report out, you know, House Bill 1. And so, again, the procedure is the floor leader will say, Mr. President, will now go to the order of business of reports from standing committees. And the president pro tem will recognize each chairman of a committee, and they will say, your chairman, your committee on housing and urban development has a report. He says, send it forward. The clerk reads the report, you know, examined it, and recommended do pass in the committee substitute for House committee substitute for House Bill 1.
Okay,
so now that.
Mm-hmm. Now, one second now. Is the title, even though this bill now applies to houses of general dwelling for human beings, and has nothing about polls, but has to do with the size of the house, is it still titled Birdhouse Uniformity Act?
No.
Okay.
It's titled Housing Uniformity Act. So birdhouses are still in there.
Okay.
All right. So they don't take everything out. They can't take everything out of the house to be substitute. They might have taken out some things, but there has to be some remnant of the original bill to make it look legit.
Okay.
But they've expanded out to housing uniformity now.
Okay.
And that way they can stick anything on. So now you have it up there. Now it goes on the calendar. And in the Senate, it goes on the formal calendar, just like it would in the House. And then the Senate, they are more sticklers to the rule that they take bills as they occur on the calendar. So, you know, House Bill 1 actually may not have been the first bill to be reported out from committee.
Right.
You know, you could have had House Bill 10 that was reported out last week, and
sure,
it's going to be first on the calendar. So what they'll do, if they want to go to House Bill 1 in the Senate, they will do what is called rolling the calendar. And so let's say they have House Bill 10 and House Bill 5 ahead of House Bill 1, and they want to do House Bill 1. The floor leader will ask the president to recognize a senator from Audrain for a motion. They'll make this motion about bringing House Bill 10 to the floor for consideration. And then it says, Mr. President, ask that calendar be laid, or that bill be laid over on the informal calendar. Remember, we talked about the informal calendar last week. So
right.
When it goes on the informal calendar, you can take those bills in any order. And they'll go through the same process for House Bill 5. They'll bring it up just like they were going to discuss it. They'll lay it over in the informal calendar, and then they'll go to the senator carrying Senate Committee Substitute for House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1. And they'll first make the motion to adopt House Committee Substitute for House Bill 1. Then they'll move for the adoption of Senate Committee Substitute. You know, these are all procedural things.
Right.
Now, unlike the House, though, the senator who's handling this bill, or actually any senator, but usually the senator who's handling the bill, can actually drop what is known as a Senate substitute. So now this Senate substitute has not been through committee. Nobody's seen it. Now, elements of it are going to be things that came out of committee and came out of the House, but they're going to largely be things that the senator has decided he wanted to add to this bill, and he can do that on the Senate floor. Without offering an amendment, he just offers a Senate substitute. Sometimes they do that because there are some technical problems with the underlying bill, with Senate committee substitute maybe.
Right.
You know, all sorts of different reasons to do that, but you can do it to change the bill in any way you want to. And so most of the time, nobody has seen the Senate substitute until it's been distributed on the Senate floor. It used to do that in the House. We changed that when we took over the majority 10 years ago, so that you couldn't do that, because you can get these huge bills dropped on you at the last minute and take them up for discussion without having a chance to read them, see what all's in there, so on and so forth. But that can still happen in the Senate.
Right.
So let's say that the senator has dropped a Senate substitute. So now he's moving for the adoption of the Senate substitute. He goes through what's in the Senate substitute. Talks about what's in there. Again, that process is just like in the House on perfection, because now they're actually perfecting this House bill. And they can make amendments to it, to the Senate substitute. If they make amendments to the Senate substitute, they can move that Senate substitute for Senate committee substitute for House committee substitute for House Bill 1 be adopted as amended, presuming that that vote it carries. There usually is a step in the Senate that if there's any cost associated with a bill, the president will refer that bill to the Fiscal Review Committee, Government Oversight Committee in the Senate. And so that's one way that he can kind of sidetrack or side rail, derail a bill, because he can send it to that committee and never call for a report on it. So he sends it off to the Government Accountability and Oversight Committee. They bring it back. They report it out. Then it's third read in the Senate. Now it doesn't really look like what passed the House.
Right.
But it's third read. Adopted. The Senate's made all their changes. And then a message is sent over to the House with the bill, telling them what they've done. So at that point, the House decides. The handler and the speaker and so on and so forth, they all get together and say, okay, what are we going to do? And it's usually they know what's happening before because they're obviously having a discussion in the Senate. And so they will either decide to take the Senate substitute as amended and the way the Senate did it, and they'll have to make a motion to adopt that Senate substitute. And then they will, if that's the case, they will truly agree and finally pass, which means it's done. No more changes. It's done. The Speaker of the House signs the bill. The President pro tem of the Senate signs the bill, and then it gets sent to the governor.
Okay, so So let's just review here for the audience real quick. We sent the bill, House Bill 1. And listen, folks, just real quick before we get into the review. If you are ever reading the journal, understand these things that Carl has just talked about. Because what you're going to see when you go looking for the bill that you've been following is something like SCS to S or S. SS to SCS1 to HCS1 to HB1. And you just need to understand that there's some substitutes, some committees, and so understand that you're looking at Senate substitute SS1 to SCS1, Senate Committee Substitute 1 to HCS1, House Committee Substitute 1 to HB1. And somewhere in there, you're tracking that all the way back to your birdhouse bill that you started following.
But you probably don't recognize.
So that's why it can become very, very hard for just an average citizen like you and I to follow these things, because if you take 2 or 3 or 4 days off and then go back looking for this thing. Now, what you can do is when you go to house.mo.gov, if you still just put in HB1, if you knew what the birdhouse bill was, it will tell you, you'll have a little click there that says, all action, and you'll see that HB1 become HCS1, become SCS1, become SS1. So follow the things from where you know what they were forward, instead of trying to follow anything backward, unless you're just into punishing yourself. So anyway, we introduced the bill. Yeah, go ahead.
On that action list that you're talking about, you can actually see once in the House, for example, if House Amendment 1, House Amendment 2, and House Amendment 4 were adopted, it will say that, and it will give you the page in the journal that you can actually go and see what those House amendments were. And the same thing with the Senate action as well.
And not only see, but when you see truly passed, it'll give you a page number, and that's where you want to go to see what your guy or woman did and whether they are following, whether they're working for you or not.
Well, and we talked last week about recorded votes, so,
right.
So the Senate committee substitute out of committee would be a recorded vote.
Oh.
The vote on the Senate substitute, adopting it as amended, would be a recorded vote, and third reading it would be a recorded vote. So all of those are recorded votes through the process.
But are
and so as would be the truly agreed and finally passed in the House.
But are the general proceedings of the Senate committee recorded?
They are to some degree. They're not verbatim.
Okay.
So not some like Senate committees actually record, like budget conference committees, and we'll talk about conference committees here in a different way. But not every some committees record, but most committees do not.
Okay. So our House Bill 1 went to a committee in the House. The committee added a couple of amendments, combined those amendments into a House committee substitute, which went back to the House floor, which got approved by the House floor. So we're on the schoolhouse rock path here right now. We're headed across the Senate, and if you folks haven't been to the Capitol before, it literally is right across the hall, across to the Senate chamber. And in the Senate chamber, it was read, and it went to committee, and the committee substituted a bill to make it having to do with housing in general, people houses, or all houses, and that went to the Senate floor, where the senator who was handling it substituted a Senate substitute. That truly passed the Senate, and now went back to the House. The House passed it as the Senate had substituted it. So the House has got a bill back from the Senate that's nothing like the bill that I proposed a week ago, or in the case of the Missouri legislature, probably 10 weeks ago, and is nothing like what the House passed, even, which was nothing like what I proposed. And they've gone ahead and said, okay, that's okay. And it's on its way to the governor. Now, so let's start from the back then. with things that can go wrong here, Carl, and work backwards. What if it gets to the House and the House says, well, heck no, that's nothing like we've sent over, and we don't want to do anything with houses. What do we do?
Right. So then the sponsor of the bill in the House would make a motion to ask the Senate to recede, or, you know, to change their mind, to withdraw all of their amendments and a substitute, and failing to do so, grant the House a conference on the bill. And so that motion is adopted by voice vote, and that message is sent back to the Senate. And they say, you know, they refuse to recede and ask a conference thereon. The handler in the Senate would make a motion that the Senate refuse to recede and to grant the House a conference thereon.
Okay.
So,
now, if you folks out there are interested in finding some examples of this stuff Carl's talking about, follow the Rabies bill. The Rabies bill started in the Senate, said anybody who has a dog or cat has to go to the vet to get a rabies shot. It went to the House. The House watered that down quite a bit, saying that any citizen who has a cat or dog that bites someone has to be able to prove that that cat or dog has a rabies shot, which was a ton different than what the Senate sent them. They sent it back to the Senate. The Senate sent it back to the House. The House sent it back to the Senate. Carl, I'm getting confused here. The House sent it back to the Senate, changed, watered down. The Senate said, oh, no, House, you're going to have to back off of some of these changes. The House said, no, we're not backing off. And the Senate took what the House sent over, and we ended up with a watered-down version of the rabies bill that, although none of us like, we can certainly live with more than we can live with what was there before. So, folks, go follow that bill, and you'll see exactly what Carl's talking about here. Now, go ahead, Carl. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. So, you know, the handler in the Senate could just as easily said, I move that the Senate recede from its position and adopt, you know, and go back and adopt House Committee substitutes, and which would have been a truly green, finally passed issue. That doesn't happen very often, very rarely. And so now what we have actually is this motion that says the Senate refuses to recede from its position and grant the House a conference thereon. They vote on that by voice vote. And then what happens is the Speaker will appoint 5 members to a conference committee. There'll be 3 members from the majority party, 2 members from the minority party. One of those 3 will be obviously the sponsor of the bill. And usually the sponsor can request who else he would like to have on the conference committee, at least from his party. And the Speaker will generally grant that, sometimes not, but generally will grant that. The same thing over in the Senate. The Senate President Pro Tem will appoint a 5-person conference committee to meet as well. And so now you have what are called conferees appointed. And here's where people get really confused because they think there's going to be a meeting. And sometimes there is a meeting. If there is a conference committee meeting, for example, people may have attended, they've been to the Capitol, a budget conference committee. And they actually do meet. They sit around the table and they discuss and so on and so forth. But there is no public input at that point. I mean, there's no public testimony. There's nothing beyond that because all that's been done. So this is just a meshing out of the differences and seeing what they can agree on between the House conferees and the Senate conferees. And it takes at least 3 members from each side to sign a conference committee report in order for it to be offered back to the House or the Senate. So they go through that process. If they can agree, they will sign what's called a conference committee report, and it'll have the signatures. Everybody's signature line will be on there. Not everybody signs a conference committee report because they didn't agree. But as long as they have 3 from each side, they're good. So that can happen either in person around a table, but what normally will happen is they already know what the problems are. The House sponsor, the Senate handler will get together and say, okay, we know we can't do this, we won't do this, and so on and so forth, and they agree on what the product's going to be. They then go back to their respective conferees go over what the changes are proposed in this new conference committee substitute, and the conferees decide whether they can live with that or not. And obviously, again, you have to have three people signed from each side. If you get those three people, you're good to go. There's a conference committee report. It's a one-page sheet that's signed with signatures. That's offered. It would go back to the House first. The handler in the House would make the motion to adopt the conference committee report. There would be discussion about what the changes were, and then there would be a vote on that conference committee report. That's not the end of it, because now you're actually going to vote on the bill. And the bill is now a conference committee substitute for Senate substitute, for Senate committee substitute, for House committee substitute, for House Bill 1.
Right.
So you got this long train and chain thing. So now you're voting on the conference committee substitute in the House. It's a recorded vote, and it has to have 82 votes to pass. That goes over to the Senate. The Senate will go through the same gyrations. They'll adopt the conference committee report, and then they will pass the conference committee substitute. Although when they pass the conference committee substitute, it will then be truly agreed and finally passed and be sent to the governor.
Okay. So basically the conference committee got together, five from each chamber, because the House would not agree to all the changes that the Senate had made to House Bill 1, which went to the Senate as House Committee Substitute 1 for House Bill 1. But by the time the Senate changed it and it got back to the House didn't like it anymore. So they
right.
The House got five members together and the Senate got five members together, and they hashed out the differences and came to some compromise that they imagined both sides of the rotunda could live with.
Right. So here's a very good distinction. You know, I said differences, you said differences. So if there was something, some language that was exactly the same in the House committee substitute that went to the Senate, and that same language didn't get changed and it was exactly the same in the Senate substitute that went back to the House, that cannot be changed in the conference committee. Without an approval from both sides, both the House and the Senate, to exceed the differences. It's called exceeding the differences. And again, that doesn't happen very often at all either. But so if there are no differences, that cannot be changed in conference committee. It's only the differences. You know, Senate substitute dealt with all houses, and it dealt with, you know, instead of 10 by 20, now you can have 10 by 40. Well, none of that was in the House. House bill. So that's a difference, and obviously that would be something they could talk about and change or delete completely.
Right.
And so it has to be somewhere between the House committee or House version and the Senate version. Those are the differences.
But if coming out of the Senate substitute, the polls were 25 feet high, just exactly the way they were in the House, the joint committee can't do anything about the 25 feet.
No, the conference committee. So it's a conference committee.
Right.
They can, because it left the House at 50. So,
right.
So we're talking about what actually passed the House, not what was in the original proposal.
Okay.
So
right.
So even though the original proposal had 25 feet, it actually passed the House at 50.
Okay.
And if they changed it back to 25 in the Senate, that's a difference between what the House passed and what they passed.
Right. But if it had come out of the Senate also at 50, then that's not up for debate.
That's correct.
Okay. So what happens if this committee can't come to any agreement? The thing just goes in the trash and it's dead?
Yep. The bill's pretty much dead. I mean, there's no way to – you know, there are ways to back out. They can dissolve the conference. Let's say the House says, okay, we'll take the Senate substitute. The House could dissolve the conference committee, which means it goes away, and they could vote to truly agree and finally pass the Senate substitute.
Okay.
Or the Senate could dissolve the committee. They can't ask for the Senate substitute back.
Right.
The House would have to make another motion to send it back to the committee or Senate to ask them to recede from their position, and then they could do so.
I see. Okay. Go ahead.
Well, that does happen from time to time, and you'll see conference committee reports number one, number two, which means that the conference committee didn't make it the first time, so had to go back and redo it. But most of the time, it's usually an up or down deal. They're either going to agree or they're not going to agree.
Okay, so let's back up a little farther. Past the House not receding to where the bill is still in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
If the Senate says no to the bill, in totally, it goes to the Senate committee, it comes to the floor, and the Senate says no, it's dead, right?
It's dead.
It's dead. If the Senate committee says no, it's dead.
Correct.
Okay. The Senate committee doesn't ever report anything out. Don't pass, do they? If they don't want it to pass, they just kill it right there, right?
Right. I mean, if they don't want it to pass, they won't vote on it. If they think they are close and they have a vote and it doesn't pass, then it just doesn't get reported out.
Right.
I mean, you really can't report something else that does not pass or do not pass. You know, there's provision and rules both in the House and the Senate. You can't make negative motions. So that would fall somewhat under a negative motion. The Senate committee would probably, knowing they don't have the votes, just not vote on the bill.
Okay.
And so it dies there. If it can't pass in the Senate or doesn't pass on the Senate, you know, because let's say in our example, the Senate fails to adopt Senate substitute. Okay,
right.
No big deal. They could actually offer a second committee substitute or Senate substitute if they wanted to, and sometimes there are multiple Senate substitutes. But let's say they didn't adopt the Senate substitute. Well, now they're back to the Senate committee substitute.
Oh,
they
I see.
They could then vote on that.
Okay.
And send that to the House. Or they could say, no, we don't like Senate committee substitute either, and now they're back to the House committee substitute.
Okay.
Now, if they vote down the House committee substitute after they've gone through all that, then the bill is totally dead.
Truly dead. Not truly passed,
right.
Truly dead. Okay.
Right. And that would be an unusual circumstances for them to back off that far, but it is procedurally possible.
When you say that would be an unusual circumstance, are you saying that usually when the House sends something to the Senate, it gets some kind of action?
No. No, there are a lot of bills that die in the Senate, and a lot of Senate bills that die in the House without much, if any, action. But what I'm saying is that it's unusual for them to not approve a Senate substitute and then not approve a Senate committee substitute and then approve a House committee substitute.
Sure, yeah. Well, that makes perfect sense, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so that takes care of some of the problems it could have encountered before it got truly passed, signed by the Speaker, signed by the President pro tem, and sent to the Governor. Now, let's move on with the Schoolhouse Rock thing and see what happens over in the Governor's office.
Well, the Governor's office goes through this process. His staff reviews it. What does it really do? Are there problems with it? Do they think there are constitutional problem issues with it? For example, the governor today vetoed House Bill 1900, which became a Christmas tree bill. That's what you call the ones that you hang everything on, because it exceeded the original scope of the bill, the original title. And so that was part of his review process. And then there are obviously things that the governor doesn't agree with. You know, he doesn't agree with, you know, whatever he choose what it might be. He can veto a bill because he believes that's the wrong direction for the state to go, or doesn't agree on principle or whatever. He literally doesn't have to have a legal reason to veto.
Some politics actually gets involved here.
Yeah, believe it or not. So
yeah.
So then if it gets vetoed, he sends a veto letter to the Speaker and the pro tem, and you know, everybody can get a copy of that. If he signs a bill, like today he signed down in Springfield, actually, a bill dealing with autism services.
Right.
Once he signs the bill, it goes to the Secretary of State, because now the Secretary of State is in charge of making sure that it gets into the statutes and so on and so forth, and it's officially recorded. There's actually a register that puts in the statutes, but Secretary of State's office is the official repository for those signed bills.
Right.
But on a veto, what will happen now, for example, on House Bill 1900, is that in September, by the Missouri Constitution, the legislature is required to meet on the first Wednesday after the first Monday of September to consider all the vetoes the governor has made to legislation. And at that point, motions may or may not be made to override the governor's vetoes of any specific bill.
Right.
And in the case of budget bills, in Missouri's Constitution, the governor does have a line item veto. Now, he can't change language. He can't veto out language. He has to veto the whole line, which includes language and dollar amount.
Right.
And so any one of those line items can be brought up to be overridden as well. It takes 109 votes. That's a two-thirds majority in the House. And it takes 23 in the Senate to override a veto in the Senate. So that would all will occur in September. For the most part, vetoes are not usually overridden.
Even when there's such a vast majority of the other party than the governors and as we have now.
Yeah, because if you look at the Republican breakdown in the House, it's 106 Republicans to 57 Democrats. They're three short of an override.
I see.
That doesn't mean they can't attempt it. They may even have a vote, but you can't count on getting all 106 of the Republicans necessarily.
That's right.
But now I will say that this year there was a governor veto overridden on the redistricting bill. And what happened is governor vetoed that. They were able to get three Democrats to vote with them and all the Republicans. And so they did get 109 in the House, and the Senate has a 24 Republicans, so they got their 23 votes they needed.
Pretty easy
to override it. Yeah. So that did happen during the session this year.
Okay. So now this veto session, now this isn't a special session, folks. That's a totally different thing. This is
correct.
A thing they have. This is a thing they have virtually every year, because virtually every year there's some sort of a veto. But this veto session only deals with bills that the governor vetoed after the boys and girls went home, right?
Right, right. And so actually they don't have a choice. Even if the governor doesn't veto anything, by the Constitution they have to meet at noon on that first Wednesday after the first Monday.
Okay. So it might just be have a cup of coffee together and go home.
Yeah. So and it's very rare that the governor doesn't veto anything, regardless.
Right.
And the veto session itself is usually only one day. It can stretch out into two. This year, for example, what will happen is they'll have they already know where they're going to have the votes and attempt to override anything on Wednesday. And that'll either happen on Wednesday or it won't. And then probably on Thursday they'll meet again, but it'll be to say hail and farewell to the term-limited members of the House and Senate.
Okay, folks, so there we've got Senate Committee Substitute, or Senate Substitute, to Senate Committee Substitute 1, to House Committee Substitute 1, to House Bill 1, through the governor, and it's been delivered to the Secretary of State. It's now law that your birdhouses have to be 50 feet from the road on a 25-foot pole. Your doghouses have to be red, and in addition, the biggest house you can have is 40 by 60 or whatever it is Carl said. That is the logistics, basically. Now, if we've left anything out, if you have any questions about what we've said, call 347-677-1835, 677-1835, and ask that question. Participate in this conversation, because this is really important. I mean, there is a lot of misunderstanding about just the logistics of getting this bill across the street. We're going to take a break now that we've talked about the logistics, and then when we come back from break, Carl and I are going to leave the logistics behind, and we're going to talk about some of the politics involved in this. This is Dave. This is Missouri Grassroots Radio Network. This is the Hour of Truth, and we're talking with Carl Bearden.
Thank you.
Okay, Missouri Patriots, I don't have to remind you that our ancestors fought and died for our right to exercise our voices and shape government in the interests of the people. And yet, in most elections, less than 20% of the population bothers to vote. Gas prices are outrageous, the economy is a disaster, and we are being regulated to death. Bad government and weak leadership are destroying the American way of life on a national and state level, and it's time to send a message to Washington, D.C. and Jefferson City and tell them we have had enough. If you're not registered to vote, the deadline to be eligible to vote in the August primary is July 11th and October 10th for the general election in November. The Patriot Revolution begins in 2012, and it happens at the polls. Vote in the August primary and the November general elections, and bring a friend. The Constitutional Republic depends on it.
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
This is Dave, and we are here to turn that tide. We've got Carl Bearden here. Carl, before we move on with our discussion, get in a plug for your group and tell people how to find you.
Sure. You can find us at United4, that's F-O-R, Missouri, spelled out, .org, UnitedForMissouri.org. We actually have two organizations. One's United for Missouri's Future. That's a 501c3 nonprofit tax-exempt organization that tries to educate our citizens about what's going on. So we try to educate and communicate. And then United for Missouri is a 501c4, and that's where we try to activate people. You know, this year we had nearly 25,000 emails sent to legislators on two or three specific issues that they were considering, one being, for example, the health care exchange bill, Senate Bill 464, where we backed Senator Schaaf throughout the committee process. People got engaged in that, made a difference. Another example would be the $50 million that the governor wanted to take to establish the foundation for the Obama health care exchange. People weighed in on that. That came out of the bill in the Senate, and a victory for grassroots and small government was, at least a small victory was gained this year. So it happened because people got involved and engaged, and that's what we're seeing today, is that if you're willing to get engaged, you can make a difference. Sometimes it's a long haul, but you can make it happen.
And there are Carl's group is great at this, great at raising the flag for us people. I mean, you know, listen, listeners, you and me, you and I, however I'm supposed to say that, you know, we go to work managing a little grocery store somewhere. We work 65 hours a week. We come home. We've got a wife and a couple of kids. We like to get in a couple of rounds of golf a month. And so we don't. I mean, who of us has time to follow this darn birdhouse bill that we care a lot about? I mean, you can't. The fact that we don't have the time for it doesn't mean that we don't care passionately that we want to have our birdhouse right out there on the street, on the curb, where the neighbors can enjoy the birds, and we care about that. But we can't follow this crap from day one till the day the governor signs it. We don't know how to follow this. If we knew how, we wouldn't have the time. I mean, you've listened to Carl now, so you know how. But that doesn't mean you have the time. So there's Carl out there, and I want to push Carl, but I also want to say there are lots of different organizations. There's Ron Calzone and Missouri First, and some of these groups even are single issue groups. There's Gretchen Logue out there, the Watchdog for Education. There's Lisa Payne Nager, the Homeschool United. There are people out there who just pick out every bill that has to do with their special interest, and they follow those bills. And you can always find those people out there who will get on their email list and get alerted every time something that you're interested in comes up and starts moving one direction or the other up there in Jefferson City. So Carl and the folks like him do a tremendous service for us in keeping us up to date and getting us involved when we need to be involved, because we just don't have time literally to spend on this like these folks who really just do this full time. I don't know how you make a living doing this, Carl. So
the rule is I have to put food on the table.
There you go. I'm going to get in one quick 15 or 20 second plug. Monday night on the Hour of Truth, we're going to have a conversation with Cynthia Davis. Cynthia's running for Lieutenant Governor, Constitution Party. What a fireball, man. I'm telling you, that is going to be one fun interview. On Thursday, we're going to talk with Lloyd Sloan. Lloyd is pitching at the federal level a repeal amendment. It's something that Madison envisioned a couple of years ago, James Madison, and it's passed on down. It's kind of been forgotten, and Lloyd's going to give us some brilliant insight into one way we could, if we wanted to, take power back at the state. And then a week from Monday night, on the Hour of Truth, we're going to have a conversation with Bill Randles, who's running for governor. Be sure and tune in. Get your questions in to those people. Get your phone calls in. Those are going to be all three great conversations, as worthy and as active as this one. Okay, now there's some politics involved. Let's talk about something right now that actually came into play this year that a lot of people don't understand. A lot of people see a dirty word connotation to it. A lot of people see it just the opposite and start rah-rah and every time it occurs. Let's talk about the filibuster.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Senate, and so we should distinguish, for example, what the Missouri Senate does versus the U.S. Senate.
Right.
The U.S. Senate has a procedure called cloture, and cloture is not the same as a filibuster.
Right.
All cloture means is you have to get 60 votes in order for someone to be able to start talking about a bill. In the Missouri Senate, what happens is one person can stand up and talk about anything they desire to talk about when a bill is brought up and seeking to be passed in the Senate. And so that it's a dual-edged sword. You know, as you said, when people get up, Chuck Ferguson gets up and filibusters, it's usually on something that most of us as conservatives would agree the state shouldn't be involved in or shouldn't do. When someone say Senator Victor Callahan from Kansas City, who doesn't have the same philosophy, he's a nice guy. I mean, and I think we talked about last week. Most of these folks are all good people. They're just some of them are more off track than others. But when Senator Callahan gets up and starts talking, as they did, for example, on the nullification bill,
right?
And he was assisted by other members of his caucus. We wouldn't agree with the filibuster in that case, but it is something that with 34 senators, each one of them has the right, if you will, to engage in a filibuster at any time.
Okay, and so up comes the prescription drug bill, which is passed the House, and it's in the Senate. It's had all the public hearings, and the public hearings were very much against it by more than a fair margin. Now, listen, I don't want to make it sound like they did a bad thing up there, because understand that at these public hearings, and if these are to say that at the public hearing the sentiment was against something, is not to say that the public sentiment is against something or for something, because the people who go to these hearings are the activists. They're the Carls and the Rons and the Yous and the Me's sending in witness forms. You can't put a pulse on how the general public feels by what goes into or comes out of these committee public hearings. But anyway, at the committee public hearing, the sentiment was against this, but it came to a vote, or it didn't come. It came to the floor in the Senate anyway. And tell us what happened there, Carl.
Well, the Senate brought it up several times.
Right.
And at each occasion, there were a number of senators who stood up to defend what they believed was the liberty that we enjoy of not having all of our personal medical histories, if you will, and prescriptions disclosed. So Senator Robshaw from St. Joseph was the lead, took the lead in filibustering the bill, and he spent the most time doing it. But Senator J. Jim Lemke helped him out. I mean, there are a number of different senators who engaged in tying this bill up. And the closer you get to the end of session, the less time that you're going to get for a bill, particularly if it's going to get filibustered, because there's just not that much time left. But that this bill was brought up at least three times, if not four, and each time it was filibustered. And I believe you mentioned last week where Senator Schaaf and others read emails from people who were opposing what was being proposed in the prescription drug monitoring program. And so again, you know, individual involvement can and did make a difference in that issue.
So then not only could the Birdhouse bill have been voted down by the Senate or killed by the committee, but if it made it through committee, six or seven senators could have just kept it from ever happening.
Yeah, I mean, and technically one senator could. It just depends on how, Mr. Smith goes to Washington. Back when the Senate, U.S. Senate actually did a filibuster.
Yes.
One senator did, and Chuck Ferguson, I believe, was the last single filibuster back in the special session when they were doing the tax credits for Ford Motor Company. I believe it was the last fall or 2 years ago or so. But there is an endurance issue. I mean, you can only last so long, and he went quite a ways. Senator Matt Bartle used to be good at it as an individual filibuster. But if you have two or more senators that are willing to stand up and take turns, you might as well just count them out, because that bill is not going to happen.
Okay. Now, let's talk quickly about, and I don't know if this is politics or just logistics, Carl, but I introduced House Bill 1 in the House, and when I pull up the journal, I see that an identical bill, Senate Bill 14, with identical title and identical wordings, is sitting over in the Senate not doing anything. How and why does this happen?
Well, you were riding into the Capitol with your senator.
Okay.
And so you both thought that was a great idea, but you had a bigger burden to do it. And so he said, I'll file one over in the Senate in case something happens to yours, and that way we'll have it covered on both ends. But we'll try to move yours, and we'll have mine in reserve.
Okay.
Now, that's the best explanation. The other explanation is, that is a good idea, but why should he get credit for it? I want credit for it. I'm going to sponsor the bill because I plan on running for XYZ office, and I want my name on the Birdhouse bill.
Okay.
And quite frankly, something we discussed, where the Birdhouse bill became something larger and maybe not as attractive and got passed, I could, as a senator, say, look, my bill was pretty simple. All I did was birdhouses.
Okay.
And so I can go out and I can tout to my constituents or to whomever that cares that I sponsored this bill.
Okay. So now I've sponsored this. Now moving on to a different subject. I've sponsored this bill. Why do I want, and how many co-sponsors do I want? Do I have to have co-sponsors?
There's no requirements for co-sponsors whatsoever. The reason to get co-sponsors would to be some show of force, if you will, that you've got a fair amount of whether it's the House or Senate, members of your body who support your idea.
Right.
And, so you try to get as many sign on as possible to show that you've got some oomph behind the bill. If you look at bills that didn't go anywhere or didn't pass, some of them had quite a few sponsors. So it really doesn't matter all that much. But from appearance sake, it does appear to be. And what happens, and people who get elected this time, excuse me, as freshmen, will be asked to sign on to bills. And it happened to me. I learned quickly. But, you'll be signing on to bill that you thought was pretty good, and then you really start paying attention to what it did. I wish I hadn't done that.
Yeah.
But you'll get tempted to do that in a lot of cases.
Okay. And then there is, again, the same politics, right? I mean, I'm running for re-election in 2 years, and it's just really good if I can have my name on some good stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So you try to, and if you know, and it depends because, let's face it, most voters are lazy. I mean, how else can you explain the situation we're in today?
Right.
And so I can go out on my campaign list and say, oh, I sponsored a bill to do this. Oh, I sponsored a bill to do this. Well, you know, what did you do? Did it actually pass? Did you even try to get it passed? You know, how did you fight for that bill? Nobody's going to really ask that. Oh, I like that bill. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Right.
And so that's what a lot of those things are used for.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly right. I mean, and you're right. I mean, most voters are not activists. Most voters aren't even knowledgeable. And why else could Claire McCaskill dare to say that she'd passed a budget? And she's going to get away with it. I mean, you know, it just really is that simple. Okay. What really do I need to do in the politics when I get to the office? How many representatives do I need to talk to? Do I need to start right away in clearing some groundwork for this bill?
Yeah, you need to. The worst thing you could do is think it's a no-brainer, which it may or may not be, and just take things for granted. The interest in a birdhouse bill just because you ran off in a ditch or almost ran off a ditch, for somebody else isn't going to be quite as high. And so if you really want to see success, you need to start talking to your colleagues. You need to start telling them why it's an important bill and how it helps Missouri and how it would help your constituents and their constituents in adopting what you proposed. Because if you don't do that, your bill is either going to languish and die along the process, or it's not going to have 82 votes it needs to get out of the House or 18 out of the Senate. And so you really have to do that. And one of the ways that happens is you try to develop relationships with people. And what the House has done, and the Senate actually is part of it, but they don't do it quite as much, is normally they have what they call a freshman tour. And what happens the first week is an orientation in Jefferson City, filling out all their paperwork, finding their offices, all that good stuff. In the past, it didn't happen this last cycle, but in the past it's been, you know, a week or two on the road visiting different places that taxpayer money goes. And during that travel, I thought even more important than seeing the places was actually getting to know people, even people on the other side of the aisle, because you need to recognize that they are a lot like you. They may not believe as you do, but you know, they're there to represent their constituents. Their constituents sent them there with their ideas, and that you know, what I always told incoming freshmen was, if you can't get up on the floor and have a great discussion, some might even say argument, and then go back in the back of the chamber and have a cup of coffee, you're not doing it right.
Right. Now, on this tour, and I've heard some horror stories about this tour. On this tour, how much of this stuff where the leadership gets this little freshman over here in the back of the bus and starts pounding on him, you know, I know your constituents sent you up here because you promised to cut government spending, but listen, Charlie, here's how it's really going to be. How much of that goes on?
If you see leadership riding the bus, something's wrong. Because they're not riding the bus. You know, when I was budget chairman, I was responsible for – that's who's actually responsible for putting on the tour. And I would ride the bus because my office was responsible for where it was going. And one of the things I tried to do was, traditionally the tour had gone, and I think maybe they've slipped into this a little bit, back into this, gone to all the places like, you know, four-year universities, every place, you know, that got on the public dole. I didn't think that was very helpful for freshmen. They needed to see, you know, private industry and different things like that actually was trying to make the state work and paying the bills. But leadership would attend dinners at night. If we had dinners, if we were in their area, there may be a couple of different stops where leadership would actually be at a function, but they don't get on the bus and ride it and twist arms.
Okay. So is there arm twisting goes on? I mean, I'm a freshman. I get to Jefferson City. I have no idea. I just ran for an office because nobody else was going to. And geez, I needed the $12,000 or whatever it pays. And I ran on a platform of cutting government spending and making things responsible. And I get up there, and what am I likely going to run into when I get there?
Well, I mean, in the scenario you just described, you're gonna run into getting run over because it doesn't sound like you really have any solid beliefs, you know, other than some big ideas, and that does happen a lot to even the best intentioned newly elected legislator. They're going to come in and solve the world's problem in the first year, and they find out it's not what they thought it was. And certainly not as easy. So what will happen, though, is you will get there will be times when they have these caucus meetings, and there will be caucus priority bills. And when I was a freshman, we were in the minority, so we didn't have to worry about that a lot because we didn't get any bills. When we moved to the majority in my sophomore year, I became budget chairman, and, you know, we had a lot of pent-up issues that we'd been waiting 50 years to do, you know, tort reform and a lot of good things. And so it was very easy to tell people and show them why we should be doing this. Now, the details sometimes were a problem, to get people to understand. But the fact that we need to do tort reform and make Missouri better in that area was not so hard. So what you do is you have these caucus meetings. You know, here are four or five priority caucus bills that we need everybody in the caucus voting on, and here's why. And then if you have a problem voting on those, you know, come talk to us and explain to us what your problem is, because maybe we just haven't explained it to you. But ultimately, you're going to vote the way you got to vote. And you may displease people, but you got to vote the way you got to vote. Now, some people don't have the intestinal fortitude to do that. And those are the ones that you have to watch because, you know, they'll fall for anything.
Now, draw a parallel for us, Carl, between the pressure that a Billy Long or a Todd Akin in the big capital undergoes with the okay, you'll never be reelected if you don't do exactly what we say kind of thing, and how much of that translates to Jeff City? I mean, is it not that overwhelming in Jeff City, is it?
No, I don't think so. I mean, the pressures at the level will be, because you're not in Congress, you haven't been through all this, will be somewhat. You'll think they're just as great as they are in Washington, but they really aren't. If you look at Washington, there's a lot of resources and campaign funding and stuff that leadership and you know, the party organization can provide to you to help you out in a tough race, and that can make the difference in your race. That can happen here on the state level too, but it's not the same level of pressure, if you will.
Right.
Most reps, for example, it used to be most reps could spend $30,000 to maybe $50,000, a lot, to get elected. It's probably a little more than that now. But so you're really not beholden to a lot. But there are reps that are in very close races where the House Republican Campaign Committee or the Democrat House Campaign Committee came and played in your race, brought some money, brought some resources, and made the difference in your race. People will then come to you and remind you about that.
Right.
If you're not falling in line. But if they didn't know, I mean, if you didn't make it clear to them ahead of time where you were and who you were going to be, then that's why you're subject to that. Doesn't mean they won't try it. But if you're staying true to what you were, then you should be able to stand up to that pressure. But a lot of people can't, and that's the problem.
Okay. In 4 minutes now, Carl, touch on anything that you think is important that you don't think we've talked about.
Well, you know, one thing that needs to happen with grassroots activists, and I know, and what you said exactly about people living their lives and have everything to do is exactly true, and that's what I tell people. That's why we try to help people to be more effective, to be their eyes and ears, and then they have to actually do something with the information we give them. But if at all possible, if you have an opportunity to get to know your rep, get to know your senator, you need to take that, whether it's you individually, you as a group, because they will respond more to people that they know or have some sort of relationship than people they don't. And so you wonder, prescription drug bills, for example, or the monitoring bill, that was so successful in the House because it made sense to the people who were hearing from the people who wanted it about all the people who were dying because of people going around and buying multiple drug prescriptions at different places or going to different doctors and getting it and then selling it like OxyContin and the people that overdose on that.
Right.
That's a legitimate issue. And so they were hearing that from people that they had some relationship. And when you have a relationship, you have some level of trust. Sometimes you know not to trust them, and sometimes you know to trust them because of that relationship. And then you hear from all the people that you've never heard from before, and you try to balance those out. And so anytime that you have an opportunity to develop a relationship with your rep or your center, you should do that because that will be an ability for you to be able to send an email or to pick up the phone and open the door for them to all these other people they don't know because you're basically vouching for them.
Right.
And that's an opportunity that you can take.
And that's and this is important, people. Be assertive. Email your senator or your representative about things that are important to you. Don't make yourself a pain in the ass now. Don't be the person that the senator just tosses in the trash because he gets three things from you every day, hollering and screaming and sounding like you're trying to run the country yourself. But be there on the important issues, on the issues that are important to you. Be there often. The senator or representative should know your name when you weigh in on something, but shouldn't know it enough that he just you know how it is when you
them again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the not him again kind of thing. That's exactly right, Carl. And pay attention to the things that matter to you. You're not going to ever be able to pay attention to everything. Pay attention to the things that matter to you, and if you're a grassroots activist, liberty matters to you. So pay attention to those things that have to do with liberty. You don't have to read or even try to follow every bill that has to do with naming a highway after a golf player, or every bill that has to do with, you know, we've got people out there that do that and just raise hell because this is such a waste of time and they're spending my money debating this, and that's fine. But if you care about liberty, if you care about freedom, then those kind of bills are things that you can just look at and say, okay, let it go, so that you concentrate your efforts on the things that are important to you. Carl Bearden, UnitedForMissouri.com, tremendous help. .org. I'm sorry, Carl. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, well,
UnitedForMissouri.org. What's it cost to join your group, Carl?
It costs nothing, but we appreciate your contributions because that helps us keep going.
Well, there you go. So Ron Calzone, Missouri First, Homeschooling United, Education Watchdog, Missouri Grassroots Coalition, of course, and we don't. I'm telling you, we don't. We're a bunch of people like you folks out there. We are a bunch of people who maybe go to a Tea Party meeting once in a while, maybe go to a Property Rights Council meeting once in a while. Once a month we have a meeting and we all get together and we have a little speaker in. But we're all people out here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition who are just like you and I. And so what we do is we count on the Carls and the Rons and the Gretchens and the Lisas to bring these things to us. So if you're at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, you're going to get it from all over. You're going to get the action alerts from the education guys, from the Missouri Precinct Project, from Homeschool United, from Carl, from Ron. Now, Carl and Ron, I mentioned Lisa and Gretchen, but Carl and Ron are a little bit more widespread in their interest than these single interest people, but you'll get it all there, and you need to be active. You need to be active. I mean, being an activist is more than just getting on Facebook and chatting about whether or not Governor Romney is going to make a good president.
Hey Dave, one thing I would say too, you made some excellent points about, you know, dealing with legislators and focusing and not being, you know, jack of all trades. You lose your strength. But the other thing, legislators, and I know firsthand, when they do something wrong, there's no shortage of people who are telling them they did something wrong. But when they do something right and they turn around, there's not a lot of people around.
Oh, yeah.
So it's important to tell people when they've done something right that you saw that they did something right and you encouraged them to continue to do that.
That's absolutely right. And be respectful. Be respectful. Yes, these people work for you. Yes, you're the employer. But by all means, be respectful. This is a tough job. And whether they're doing it right or wrong doesn't make it any less tough. So be respectful. And you're absolutely right, Carl. And that's a great point. I was a weather forecaster for 25 years. So I'm the guy who knows that when you're right, nobody remembers, and when you're wrong, nobody forgets. So yeah, by all means, thank you, Carl. Thank you very much. This has been very informative and very entertaining and a ton of fun. For me. So I appreciate it. That's Carl Bearden, UnitedForMissouri.org. And thank you very much, Carl. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Dave. Thanks for having me.
All right. I'm Dave. This is the Missouri Grassroots Radio Network. This is the Hour of Truth. Monday night, we have a conversation with Cynthia. Next Thursday night, we have a conversation with Lloyd. A week from Monday, we have a with Bill Randles, our future governor. I am the Hour of Truth. I do not make any assertions that I am fair-minded, open-minded, objective, or unbiased. We will interview people who are grassroots approved and who are people you should be listening to and voting for and wanting in your government. There'll be conversations. They won't be interviews. We're not out there to gotcha anybody. So that's what this is all about. On Tuesdays every week, Vaughn Carricker, she's back this week with Show Me Common Sense. On Wednesdays, Lisa Payne Nager with a delightful hour every week as the culture vigilante. And on Fridays, always a very exciting and entertaining Missouri Grassroots Roundtable. 7 o'clock, Monday through Friday, Missouri Grassroots Radio Network. I'm Dave. This is the Hour of Truth. Next time, we'll be talking to you.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.
Mom!